Hi, I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to The Source Code. This is the place where we like to let our original sources shine and let you get a peek under the hood at the raw conversations that I get to have with some of the smartest people on Earth, because my job is awesome. This edition is Kim Stanley Robinson, the science fiction author who wrote the famous Mars Trilogy, which is a highly detailed series of stories about the colonization of Mars. It includes the politics, the interpersonal drama, planetology, basically everything else that might go along with such a tale. And he has a new book out called New York 2140 about New York City flooded by rising sea levels, but still bustling away as the center of global commerce. So we had a super interesting conversation about that book. But first, I had to fangirl. Here's Kim Stanley Robinson in The Source Code. I should tell you now that I have been immersed in the Mars trilogy for kind of months now. I mean, you know, you have to go back and reread several parts of it. So it's a little exciting for me to be talking to you at this exact moment.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for reading it. It's very long.
It's okay. Yeah, really long works for me because I like to just immerse. And it could not be more relevant right now because obviously there's a lot of conversation about the possibility, the very near possibility of colonizing Mars. And so in your trilogy, people have done this. They have gone from Earth to Mars to colonize it. And there's this really central debate over whether Mars should be transformed to be more like Earth or whether its landscape should be preserved. How likely do you think this debate is to occur in the real world or the real Mars world?
If you give it a long enough timeline, I think it's a debate that's sure to occur. The first colonists on Mars, I now think, will be modeled kind of on Antarctica. So it'll be scientific crews and people who keep the infrastructure going up there and then rotating out after 2 or 5 years, depending on orbital cycles and return ships. So that for a long time, it might be considered to be an exotic place where we don't need to change it. But as soon as people commit to living there for their entire lives, for their own protection, they're going to want to give the place an atmosphere to protect them from radiation. And so that involves terraforming, and it's physically possible to do on Mars, which is very unusual in our solar system and probably anywhere. But the gases we need are already there, frozen, the water and the gases. So it could happen, and once people are committed to the place, I think they will want it to happen.
Do you think that debate might occur too, where we will have the conversation about whether this is an opportunity to sort of get it right when it comes to natural resources?
Well, everything we learn on Mars and all the rest of the planets in the solar system are useful information for dealing with the problems we are creating on Earth. So space science isn't our science, and comparative planetology is a powerful intellectual tool. Scientific tools. So everything that we do in our discussions of the other planets is going to be part of the conversation of what we're doing with this planet.
The first book in the trilogy is so detailed in the story of colonization that it almost reads like a history. Do you watch the conversations that are happening now around Mars colonization and think, you know, either you're welcome or I already wrote this or I can see how this is going to play out from here?
Well, I wrote my book based on the exploratory work of a group called the Mars Underground, a bunch of graduate students in planetology that were at first based at University of Colorado in Boulder. And they would put out conference papers called The Case for Mars that included a lot of details that I used. So I didn't make my scenario up. I adapted it from scientific work. So I don't need to be thanked. I'm just, the telephone operator that plugs in the various voices and then they speak. I am very interested in the current talk about Mars because there's a lot of hand-waving going on at some crucially dangerous points. It's actually very hard to land softly on Mars, and we only have about a 50% success rate with our robots. So 50% success might not be good enough when it comes to people. And also, since I wrote my Mars books, we've discovered that the surface is way more poisonous than we thought it was, because Spirit and Curiosity have revealed that there's perchlorates, a kind of a salt that is very toxic to humans, that is pretty much everywhere in the sand of Mars. So there are slower downers in the whole program of going to Mars that a lot of people, having read my books or else have the dream from some independent source, they don't want to acknowledge. But to me, the whole interest of Mars is that it's a reality. It's really there. It's not just a fantasy world we make up. So we have to be attentive to the real reality as we learn it.
There's a lot of exploration of economics in the trilogy, and obviously in your new book too, 2140, which hopefully we'll talk about in a minute. You know, you envision these transnationals, giant corporations that essentially have all the power, take exploration from a scientific to a commercial exercise. It seems our current environment, political environment and otherwise, suggests that companies will be a key part of colonizing other planets. What do you think are the dangers of that?
Oh, I think the dangers are of trivialization, that suddenly the other planets in space, instead of being a commons that all humans are interested in equally as a kind of scientific project of humanity, it just turns into another, you know, source of profit and exploitation. It's crazy, and nobody likes it. People love those first tiny little rovers on Mars because they were public projects and everybody had a stake in it. And if it becomes a rich person's playground or another place to mine, that just diminishes the interest and also the value of it for us. Now, that said, nobody can make a profit in space except for communication satellites in low Earth orbit. Everything that's on Mars, everything that's on the moon and the asteroids, is exactly the most common stuff that we have here. And so it never pencils out. So I don't worry too much about the supposed corporate takeover of space and of Mars and of the asteroid belt, because there's nothing valuable up there. It's all iron, aluminum, magnesium, dirt, stone, water, stuff we have plenty of already here on Earth, and it's stupendously expensive to go up there, get it, and bring it back down. So, again, this is a kind of a fantasy people have. One has to say that in late capitalism, you have to redistribute, you have to reinvest. Capital is not capital unless it's reinvested and it's making a profit. So places sitting on a gigantic surplus, like certain billionaires and China and other places, they need to reinvest. And if there's nothing that they deem worthy on Earth, you can always try the moon or cast that capital up into space and kick the can down the road in terms of having a problem of getting something useful out of it.
So are you skeptical about asteroid mining?
Oh, yes. Asteroids are made of iron and nickel. So big deal. And water and stone.
Huh.
So, I mean, there's no gold except in the same diffusion that it's in everywhere in the dust cloud around the sun, which means that there's like one part per 10 trillion. How are you going to gather it? And how are you going to bring it back? There's nothing valuable in the asteroids. They're kind of neat. You know, you could actually hollow them out and live inside them, as in my novel 2312. But in terms of mining, this is another kind of, you know, entrepreneurial pipe dream. Do not invest.
Do not invest. Good note. It is almost impossible, I think, not for us readers not to want our sci-fi authors to be predictive in some way, to you know, want to make you into some kind of an oracle or point to the things you got right. How hard is that for you, or if at all?
Well, it's okay. I mean, prophecy is a very ancient quality, and usually prophets are scolds and, you know, nobody really likes them. But on the other hand, prophecy is powerful. It's like being the shaman of the tribe. But science fiction does two things at once. It predicts, not predicts, but it describes scenarios of the future with a very thick texture and a plot and characters, so you can imagine what it would feel like to live in that particular future. Now, it might not be the future that comes to pass. In fact, it's almost certainly not going to be, because you can't predict the future. There are too many variables. But science fiction is also a way of talking about what's happening right now with a kind of a futuristic cast to it. It's like a metaphor or a symbol system.
I was trying to remember the name of that principle, the scientific principle that says that you can change a thing by observing it. You can change its behavior by observing it.
That's right. The Pauli exclusion principle, or just quantum mechanics. As soon as you describe a future, that's the one that's not going to happen because you've excluded it. I mean, this is quantum mechanics rather than narratology. But it's a good analogy. It really is. The future, like one time I predicted the United States and the Soviet Union were going to go on in a kind of Cold War for 50 or 100 years. I had cast my novel out, and it got published in 1988. So I'm very well aware that you can't quite predict the real future.
Yeah. What are you working on now? I know you have a fairly recent book, New York 2140, which I hope you'll talk to us a little bit about, and anything new going on?
Oh, yes. I'm writing a novel in which China establishes a big base at the South Pole of the Moon. And then the rest of the world, in shock, tries to catch up. But China has an awful lot of surplus capital and labor and expertise. And so they could do it, like, in about, you know, 5 years, and they very well might.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, our richest billionaires could also establish a base on the moon in about 5 years to 10 years. I've heard some people say it would only cost about $2 billion to do so.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we've been exploring actually on our show is this idea of technology being evenly distributed and whether, you know, how likely it in fact is that space exploration will become the province of the very rich and that, you know, the poor will be sort of left on Earth, which is part of the scenario even in the Mars trilogy, right?
Yep, it's true. The people who are sent to space are going to be a small group of people with expertise, mechanical engineering, astronaut type expertise. And so they'll be highly trained experts at first. And then maybe rich tourists will in space hotels might be some of the first guests in space. That's one scenario. But I do think that especially for Mars and for anything beyond a kind of a single one-off tourist hotel, it's going to be an international effort, and it's going to have a scientific basis where we're doing it for knowledge and we're doing it to understand better how to manage Earth as a planet. Because we're accidentally managers of Earth as a planet, and manage is even too strong of a word because we're not that good at it, and it takes a lot of physical force that we don't have, and knowledge. So we're kind of cast into the role of being caretakers, or we're trying to finesse a system that's gigantic and bigger than us, and we've already tampered with it and wrecked some features of it. So space is a place where we work on that project, and it's very important to put it that way, as a scientific and utopian project, not as a place to fool around or a place to make profit. Luckily, you can't make a profit up there. The gravity well of Earth is stupendously strong, and there's nothing up there that we need anyway. So it won't be a place to make profit. There might be a few tourists, but they'll be incidental to the larger human scientific effort.
Do you have a favorite scene from a space movie? Like, do you consume your own genre and think, okay, this is the one that absolutely got it right?
I watch almost all science fiction movies with my family, yes. And I like the ones that aren't franchises, that aren't Star Wars, and that try to do something interesting and new. So I think they're a lot of fun.
Do you have any recent favorites?
I liked, I think it was called Passengers.
Oh, really? I started to watch that the other night and I got tired. Okay, I'll go back to it.
Yeah, it's a Starship movie and, you know, they're caught on there. And the movie got a tremendous amount of grief because it was kind of a stalker movie. The guy wakes up, you know, Jennifer Lawrence. And and it looked like he was kind of a stalker over, and yet he got away with it. But actually, the movie discussed that in great detail, and the Starship was just beautiful. So I sometimes like things for partial reasons, you know.
You mentioned Antarctica as a possible model for space colonization. In fact, the likely model. Do you think that's the best one, or are there other models, better or otherwise, that could be used, like the colonization of North America?
Right. That is often presented as the competing analogy, and I think it's all wrong. And I think Antarctica is way better for how suggestive it is of how it's going to be up there. Like, we have people at the South Pole right now. Nobody cares. So I think when we have people in space having done that accomplishment, it'll be like the International Space Station, even when we get to Mars. The moment we do it, people on Earth won't care anymore. But also, you rotate crews in and out. There's no economic value, and when you get there, it's a scientific base doing scientific work, and that means it's a somewhat minor league part of the world economy. So in so many ways, also you would die there if you didn't have high tech to keep you alive, and that's true in Antarctica and way even more true in space. So the whole analogy of the new world, like, in other words, we go to a new place, we can establish a new civilization, it'll be progressive and interesting, and it'll save the human race from decadence, blah, blah. All of that's wrong. I mean, it just isn't the way space is. So it's best to pay attention to reality when you're doing science fiction, because if you don't, then you've shifted without knowing it over into fantasy, to wish fulfillments into fantasy, where you say, well, we'll science that problem away. Well, reality is not amenable to being scienced away when there are inconvenient facts like the vacuum and the lack of valuable resources and the fact that you'll die the moment you're exposed to it. I mean, that none of that was true in the New World when they crossed on ships in the open air, and all of that is true for space.
In this event where it is a ultimately scientifically minded, like Antarctic exploration or the space station, do you think that there are rules that should exist for this sort of global behavior, like a sort of a space treaty?
There is the Outer Space Treaties written and signed in 1967 by the Soviet Union, the United States, and then many other nations. And it's based on the Antarctic Treaty of 1959. So, again, the two are similar. And again, in both places, there are problems with enforcing these treaties, international agreements. There is no sheriff, and no individual nation cares enough to call other nations on it when other nations break the treaty. So it's illegal, like, to fish for the Patagonian toothfish in Antarctic waters. Some nations have allowed their fishermen to go down and do it. Other nations have not called them on it or done anything about it because it just isn't important enough. So I would say these treaties are weak, and if ever the stakes got high, the treaties would collapse. But the stakes might not be high enough. It might be a place where scientific cooperation just goes on forever. Antarctica has, aside from a few infractions, has been a place where all the nations, even during the Cold War, cooperated with each other to do scientific work. And it was as if the scientists were saying on the side, look, our countries may be crazy and in a Cold War, et cetera, but we're doing science and we're going to declare this a utopian space where everybody gets along. That was the International Geophysical Year, 1956-57. And ever since then, Antarctica has been an alternative political, social space of that kind. And I think outer space will be the same. The moment there are bases on the moon, people who are up there are going to be really friendly and cooperative with each other, no matter what nation they came from. So it's a great model. Science and the spaces where science kind of rules are a great alternative model to the kind of global economic space that we're usually in.
That is a nice segue, actually, to New York 2140, which really explores a vaguely apocalyptic future on Earth, but also a lot of economic principles. Can you tell us about that book?
Sure. I wanted to write a book about global finance and how people could kind of seize international global finance for the people's work and make it like a gigantic public utilities district or a credit union that people own. So essentially nationalizing the banks and the finance system of the world or back to this level of the individual nation states. Now, that's pretty abstract, as you just heard, and filled with economic theory and political economics. And my editor suggested to me that it being a novel, it needed to have a little more life than that. And he reminded me that I had once flooded Manhattan in my novel 2312, suggested I put this novel in that setting. So I did. It was a great idea. And New York is the center of world finance, but it's also a tremendously beautiful harbor and a great infrastructure. And, it's so much the cultural center of the United States that sometimes people think that it's like transnational and it's like a space that isn't even American. It's just New York. And it's beautiful. So I flooded it. And then, sea level rise is going to happen. They don't know how much or how fast. This is almost impossible to estimate. But right when I was writing the book, James Hansen and 18 co-authors published a paper saying that back 120,000 years ago in the Eemian period, the temperatures rose 1 degree average, which we've already done since the Industrial Revolution, and sea level shot up like by 15 meters in a century. So it was controversial, but it was actually a scientific rationalization for what I proposed in my book. So it went from being a kind of a metaphor of financial being underwater to an actual physical possibility. If all the ice on the planet melted, sea level would be like 220 feet higher worldwide. That's radical. Right. And it's not going to happen because Antarctica has so much ice on it that is, dark for 6 months of every year and won't melt for thousands of years. But it turns out there's a lot of ice perched on Antarctica's shoreline that could fall in and raise the sea level, 10 feet, 50 feet, 60 feet in the course of like the next century. And this is news. This is radical news and shocking. But the physics and the geology seem to work out. So that's the scenario I pursued in New York 2140. I had two things going on at once, essentially, climate change and financial change mixed together.
Do you feel frustrated when you hear the conversations about climate change now sort of becoming more and more politicized? And you've already imagined, I imagine in extreme detail, what it looks like when this happens. And yet now we're in a point where we're saying that's absolutely not going to happen, or some people in our government are.
You know, that's they are outliers and residuals of a. I've been talking about this for almost 20 years now, and what I would say is that there's been a remarkable change in those 21 years. And by and large, the human community is aware that climate change is already happening and that it's a real problem in the future, and that essentially we're wrecking the biosphere for our descendants. And action is being taken. So I think it's valid to take the positive view and say we've made enormous strides in the last 10 to 20 years in the scientists convincing everybody else it's a real problem. And the Paris Accord was historic. In world history, the Paris Accord will go down. And it's the first time that humanity gathered together and voluntarily submitted their economies to an environmental problem that overrid any ideological or economic considerations. And I believe the United States will jump back into the Paris Accord, and this is a temporary aberration in our own national history. But I think it's really valid to take the positive view and say we're acting about as fast as human civilization is capable of acting, and that the Paris Accord was essentially got us halfway there to the carbon reduction that we need. And so some people say the first half is the easy half. Some people say the first half is the hard half. Be that as it may, we'll find out one way or another. It still was an astonishing achievement. I'm still blown away that the Paris Accord got signed at all in the first place. And so, you know, Trump is a fool, and that's unfortunately the case. And he's got some people facilitating him, but many people are realizing this fact about him and headed for the exits. And the Paris Accord cannot be left. It's a voluntary association anyway. So many cities, many states are already abiding by it, and they're considering that they're still in it. So this is, I think, the best way to look at it. We have to work as fast as we can for the sake of our descendants, and we're not doing badly. And they're never going to convince everybody. There's always going to be a residual of 10% of people who are foolish or have economic interests that are overriding their common sense or their sense for their descendants. We're going to have to just politically overrule them and do the right thing.
And then tell us what point do you want to make about the global financial system and this idea that people, individuals, or I guess states, nations will take control of that system for their own benefit. Where does that idea come from?
Again, we've got an international treaty system, but with what happened, I think, is that capital got loose from nation state sovereignty and began finance tells states what to do, like with the Troika and the situation in the European Union. That's the same everywhere, instead of states telling finance what to do and using finance. So what I mean by that is World Trade Organization and all of the loose money that can go to the wherever they can get the rate of highest return, and nation states are no longer in control of their own economies. And if any one nation state said, well, we're going to be virtuous and environmental, or we're going to treat our labor, our people better by way of law, the international global finance community can just take their money elsewhere and go to a place with laxer laws and more chance for profit. Well, the nation state system is still the ones that are making laws that could rein that all back in. And it would have to be kind of cooperative. A lot of nation states would have to come together. But right now, if the U.S. and China were to agree on something and got the European Union and a few other nations on board, the BRIC nations, well, you could create a situation where doing the right thing by people and the environment was the only way to do business. And that would be like one step along the way to taking control of history. And, you know, derivatives, making money off of the redistribution of money, the whole parasitical aspect of finance is useless to the real economy anyway, and in fact saps the real economy. So it's a kind of question of economic reforms that are progressive, and Thomas Piketty wrote about this in his great book, Capital in the 21st Century, and there are many other analyses that show that there are things we can do to right the ship and to make finance a tool rather than a master.
So on a totally other note, do you by any chance want to tell us the title of your new book, or maybe the first line?
You know, my editor chooses my titles for me, and the reason I laugh is because I have no idea. I call it China Moon, but that's probably too obvious, and we'll see what happens. And I can't say the first line because it isn't settled yet, but I can say that the moon only has, 18% as much gravity as Earth. So to get off the moon is exceedingly simple. You just get going on a train fast enough, and then the train leaves the tracks and flies off into space. So that's kind of amazing. And what I've discovered in talking with moon scientists is that actually you can reverse that possibility too. You can just come flying into the moon at full speed, land on a track like in an airplane, except you'd be going like 10,000 miles an hour. So you don't want to look out the window when you're landing on the moon.
There's no Dramamine strong enough.
You would be thinking you were a meteor, and I don't think your adrenaline system would be happy.
I think China Moon is very romantic. For what it's worth, for
yeah,
your editor, that is just a lovely name.
As I say, at this point, I've given over to my editor my titles because he has been so good to me. So good for my books, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't care anymore, and it makes me laugh.
It is smart to have a headline writer.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree.
Yes. Yeah.
I will let you get back to the garden. We've taken up a ton of your time, but I really appreciate it. This is just wonderful.
Oh, my pleasure, and I'm happy to do it again anytime.